Yes. In other words, he didn't wait to get enough appropriation to go out and do these things. He went out and did a big job with a small appropriation and with a group of men who I believe were dedicated to this cause of law enforcement.
Did you put in a lot of overtime without pay, I presume?
Well, an awful lot. Yes, but I don't know. It just seemed like the time went fast. I think all of the agents were deeply interested in doing a good job. We had a little plaque, I remember, on the wall of one of the offices I was in that I think pretty well sums up the feeling of the agents. It's a little verse by Elbert Hubbard. You're fairly familiar with it, Neil, I'm sure. It's on loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
And the agents in charge had those little plaques shown in the various offices. Not as because you had to put them up, because it told the story and the Bureau believed, and the Bureau personnel believed in it. But it goes something like this: if you work for a man, in heaven's name, work for him. Speak well of him and stand by the institution he represents. Remember, an ounce of loyalty is worth a pound of cleverness. If you must eternally find fault and condemn, why resign your position, and when you're on the outside, diamonds are your heart's content. But as long as you are a part of the institution, do not betray it, or the first high wind that comes along may blow you away, and probably you will never know why. I think that had a good effect, you know, on the personnel.
Were there some who left under the pressure of new discipline who did leave it and damn it in those early days, and some who didn't want to be a part of an ongoing, tightly knit group?
Possibly some left, but not noticeably so.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to be all dedicated people, even right from the start after Mr. Hoover started to put the organization into shape. I think the men were interested in doing a good job.
What kind of pay did you get? I mean, was it comparable to other government workers in those days, or was it more sparse?
Well, I would say that to begin with, the wages were quite low. The Bureau was not involved in types of cases that meant any particular physical danger to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as the Bureau branched out in kidnapping and bank robbery investigations, it was recognized that the job was one that maybe had considerable physical danger involved. I remember insurance companies began to consider us poor risk.
Uh-huh.
Insurance premiums went up, and Mr. Hoover, through appearance before appropriations committees of Congress, was able to get the pay raised so that it was somewhat reasonable with other salaries of federal workers.
Gee, I wonder if we could go into what I'm sure will be an interesting part of the program for our viewers. Several of the cases that you worked on that were most memorable for you. We're all seeing Elliot Ness on TV and all these other shows, and you lived during that turbulent time when much of this was going on and you were a part of it. I wonder if you could give us some of your impressions that have been most indelibly inscribed on your mind.
Well, the FBI, as you know, is a we organization.
Mm-hmm.
The men pride themselves on being connected with a we organization. It isn't what any one individual has done, any one agent, but rather what we as an organization accomplished. Like most of the agents, in those early days, we didn't have the several thousand agents that they probably have today. We had merely a handful. I think when I started out in the Bureau, they had perhaps 300 or 400 agents covering the entire United States. And we worked closely with local and county and state law enforcement agencies, as the Bureau does and has always done. But during the course of assignments in various field divisions, with bank robbery being on the upsurge back in the 30s and kidnapping, naturally every one of the agents worked on quite a number of the cases. And it was my lot to be in Chicago for about 3.5 years, from 1930 to 1934. And during those years, we naturally worked on quite a number of these major cases.
How about the Dillinger case? Wasn't this one?
Including the Dillinger case, and the Urshel kidnapping case, and the Betcher kidnapping out of Denver. All roads seemed to lead into Chicago at
mm-hmm.
that time. Maybe not the kidnapped victims being held in that area, but some of the loot being disposed of there, and meeting with other gangsters there, these persons who perpetrated the crimes with conversion in Chicago. And during those years from 1930 to 1934, while I was there, naturally, I worked on quite a number of those cases.
How about Babyface Nelson? This is a person you won't forget, ever, I suspect.
Well, naturally, quite a number of agents worked on that case. It came about, and I think it's a matter of public record, most of the things that I might have to say about it. But in that particular case, in the Babyface Nelson case, a tip came into Chicago that the Dillingers, or members of the gang, were holed up at a hunting lodge in northern Wisconsin. I remember very vividly the day because it was an Easter Sunday, April the 22nd, 1934. You were on standby orders all the time, so it wasn't surprising to get a call from the office at my home to come down to the office immediately. I remember I had on a new Easter suit, perhaps one of the few new Easter suits I ever had, and it was a nice, beautiful, sunshiny day in Chicago. And arriving at the office, word was received that this tip had come in about the Dillingers being holed up in this hunting lodge in northern Wisconsin. And so we chartered a commercial plane and pilot, and about six of us flew up there. You can imagine what it was like leaving a sunshiny place and getting up into northern Wisconsin. We landed at Rhinelander, Wisconsin. I remember perhaps 4 or 5 inches of snow on the ground. It was stormy. The plane and setting down on a small field, and mind you, the fields and the plains weren't in those days like they are today. While the plane went up on its nose, I think damaged the propeller a little, didn't hurt anyone. Then it was a matter of renting cars and getting out to this place, so quite a number of miles up.
The lodge they were at?
Sort of a hunting lodge.
Mm-hmm.
And other agents were flown into the area from other parts. And the raid was hurriedly planned. And I don't think that anybody counted on some dogs playing a part in the case, but a couple of dogs at the lodge gave the signal by barking
for half a second
when any commotion occurred around there, and the people inside were alerted. And before the place was fully surrounded by the members of the gang, some of them had been able to escape out the back way. It was right on a little lake, I think it was near Spider Lake, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. It was occurred. So during the course of the raid, the agent in charge, who was Marvin Purvis, who died incidentally just a short time ago.
Yes, I was going to say, I thought I noticed
that. He was directing the raid, and he directed a fellow agent and made her go down to a telephone and make a phone call. And while we were out, I was driving this car, and while we were out, we stopped at a house, and it proved to be the house of a deputy sheriff. I believe the deputy's name was Carl Christensen. And we notified him about the raid so that members of the sheriff's office wouldn't come in trying to find out what it was about and perhaps create a problem, and we wanted their help too. So we notified him, and he was rather insistent that he go along with us. And we finally consented, and while we were out, before we went back to the lodge, we saw an abandoned automobile. So we went to a house nearby that the deputy knew belonged to a local resident, and he said, we can ask a fellow up there who owns this car down here. They figure into this thing. We didn't know at that time that any members of the gang had escaped through the back of this lodge. So we went into this farmyard, and I just parked, and I was just lowering the window on my side when one of these members of the Dillinger gang who had escaped from the back of the lodge, and who incidentally had abandoned the car, it wasn't workable or something, he was hiding behind another car waiting to make a getaway, and he opened fire on us. The agent was a big chap, Carter Baum. He was about 6'4", a fine specimen of a man, had held, I believe, the tennis championship of the District of Columbia about 3 years. He was shot in about this area. Incidentally, he had a bulletproof vest on, and he was shot about a half inch above. I had a bulletproof vest on, and he was shot right in the forehead here.
The
deputy did not have a bulletproof vest on, and he was shot about 5 times right in the abdominal area.
Good night.
And I was knocked unconscious, but came to rather quickly and was able to shoot, but I'm afraid I didn't do much good in the shooting.
You have a little memento of that experience.
Oh, yes. I rather apologize in showing this because I don't know whether anybody would take any particular delight in
seeing. I think our viewers would be interested to see this.
It isn't a thing of beauty, I would say, but it's something that's been in a filing cabinet at my home for many years. And incidentally, none of my 11 grandchildren has ever seen this.
But then this is a premier.
Not over a half a dozen people have seen it. But I ran on it the other day, ran onto it, and it shows where the bullet entered here, and just creased my forehead here and came out here. Well, it required about 6 or 8 stitches in my forehead. I felt sorry particularly for the other two. Of course, Carter Baum was killed almost instantly. The deputy sheriff and I rode, we couldn't get medical attention around in that part of Wisconsin and had to go to Iron Mountain, Michigan, I believe it is, quite a number of miles away, maybe 30, 40 miles over very bad roads in those days. It was a matter of traveling, as I recall, about 3 or 4 hours to get the 40 miles because we would get stuck and had detours, and it was a terrible trip. And sitting next to the deputy on the way in, I wasn't bad off, believe me. But the deputy, being shot up the way he was, he was sinking very fast. And I remember when we got to the hospital, a very little hospital, one doctor hospital, the doctor had been notified and was there to greet us.
Mm-hmm.
I remember he got us into beds, and he came over to me. He said, "You're going to make it all right," but he said, "Your friend just can't possibly make it." I went in to see this deputy before I left, a big, long, lanky Texan who had settled up in northern Wisconsin, a fine fellow. I saw him, but he was still under sedation. They hadn't been able to operate due to his suffering from shock. I talked to his wife, and you know, she surprised me. I expressed the hope that he'd get along all right, and she said, "Oh, he'll get along all right. He'll be out of here in no time." And he was. Congress, I think, voted him several $1,000s because of his impairment on the assistance, particularly because of the hospital bills. He must have been in a long period of time of convalescing from that.
Along with yourself, Jay, another man well known to many of our viewers would be Sam Calley, who was not so fortunate. Was this the same gang that he ran afoul of?
Yes, later on in that same year in Chicago, about October the 22nd, as I recall, because we used to discuss among ourselves where we might have planned this thing for the 22nd of the month, because quite a few of these things appeared.
but it was just happenstance.
I think it was October the 22nd when Sam Colley, with whom I worked in Chicago, and Herman Hollis, with whom I worked in Chicago and in Cincinnati, had a run-in with Babyface Nelson in Chicago, and he died as a result of the wounds that he received at their hands, and unfortunately they were shot by him and died.
I suppose when a lot of these hoods were rounded up finally, or gunned down in defiance of the law, this would be something that that one wouldn't rejoice at death. You'd feel good about ending an era, wouldn't you, and seeing men like Bonnie pass from the scene?
Well, I'll say, because it seemed rather bad when people who were engaged in nefarious business such as they would take the lives of fine, reputable people like Sam Colley, who was an outstanding man. I knew him very well. He was an inspector, and he was in charge of the Dillinger raid in Chicago that netted Dillinger, and was very highly thought of by the director. As a matter of fact, I heard, and I'm sure I'm correct in this, but Mr. Hoover said on one occasion that he had in mind making Sam an assistant director. He was an inspector, I think, at the time of the killing in Chicago.
Jay, shifting gears a little bit, do you think the shows on crime on TV, on the whole, help or hinder law enforcement?
Be debatable, I guess. But I really think that any show that shows the law enforcement officer in his proper light as being somebody who is decent and fine and engaged in the business of protecting the lives of people, showing him in that light.
Yes.
And the crook being the low character individual that he is, I think it would have a salutary effect on young viewers.
Do you worry about the ruddy gore that goes with it sometimes, as far as what young minds may absorb in this regard?
Well, frankly, I do, but...
Of course, this is a part of life, isn't it?
That's right.
How about the FBI's role? Often people look at it as a kind of panacea that they can solve almost anything. I suppose there were plenty of times when you lacked jurisdiction and therefore couldn't move in, even though you might want to.
That's true, because quite a number of these major offenses are state offenses, mm-hmm. and not necessarily federal. And the FBI would not have jurisdiction to go in and handle certain of these offenses. But the Bureau does have jurisdiction over a great many of them now, and within recent years, of course, recent to me because I've been out of enforcement quite a while, but Congress has passed laws which help the FBI to help the local and county and state law enforcement agencies, and there's a very close bond of cooperation existing between the FBI and the local and the county and the state agency. I know of this because being with a state law enforcement agency at the present time, I know of this fine spirit of cooperation.
You're referring to a hat. Reminds me that you wear a new hat now, of course, as Commissioner of Public Safety. And where we've talked about the tragedy involving a few lives, now you're concerned with tragedies that have taken how many lives in Utah so far this year?
So far this year, we have had 242 fatalities. By the time I left the office this evening, I hope it hasn't gone up since then. And 190 fatal accidents. Last year, during the same period, only 191 people were killed. I believe that'll be 51 more people killed this year than last year in the same period.
Mm-hmm.
And last year, that occurred in 160 accidents. A lot of them this year have been multiple fatality accidents. In other words, in several of these accidents, 3, 4, and 5 people have been killed in one accident. And we had a greater incidence in that this year than last year, which might account in part for the
otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going to ask you kind of a radical question. If we can see nothing on the horizon but more people, more cars, and more speed, is anything short of a radical solution really going to ameliorate this this condition?
Well, certainly more attention is going to have to be given to the behavior of the driver. And I really would like to put out an appeal to people. I think a lot of people think that these fatalities on our highways occur through some mystic thing or some unexplained thing.
Mm-hmm.
No, these are the acts of people. The drivers who perhaps do not give the proper attention to their driving, who do not obey the rules and regulations of safe driving, or who are willful violators of the driving laws of the state. And I think if more people would recognize that these driving rules and regulations are for our safety, that it's certainly immoral to violate these rules. I think a lot of people think that when they get caught, they've had bad luck rather than that they have violated the law.
Yeah, they weren't clever enough, they feel.
I think we're going to have a kind of a rebirth of the fundamental things that cause these accidents and the feeling and thinking along that line so that each will assume his responsibility for driving safely.
How about the question of safety belts? Is this a something you would recommend personally?
Very much so. I'm highly in favor of it. Of course, the patrol, highway patrol with which I'm connected,
yes,
certainly believes wholeheartedly in it because we have safety belts in all of our cars and the men are cautioned continually to make sure that they are fastened. And quite a number of our men in the patrol can attribute their lives today because of having seat belts and having them fastened at the time of some accident that they've been in.
Jay, in the few moments remaining, do you have any hobbies that absorb some of your free time, such as you have?
Well,
what do I like to do?
I live in Holiday, and my wife, who is a Salt Lake City girl, Janine Jacobs, we have a place out there. I have a horse, and when I can, I do a little riding. Mm-hmm. I like gardening, and we have two sons who are married, a married daughter, and a daughter who's down at the Y now. In fact, she's the one that rides the horse, Murphy.
Yes,
the one down at the Y. And we have our 11 grandchildren that we love very much.
How did your wife feel during these moments of crisis? Did she ever wish you'd sell furniture or do something else for a living?
Well, she was a brick. She took it in stride. No doubt at times she wondered whether or not I was going to come home in one piece. But she bore up very, very well, and certainly she was all that a person would expect in a dedicated wife, somebody who backed her husband up in the job.
Jay, you've worked with people in situations where you've seen the underside of life as it is. Do you feel optimistic about men, people, their ability to cope with the world's
problems? Oh, yes. I think that as long as we've got forward-looking men, a lot of dedicated people today, I think we're going to stay pretty well on the right track. I dislike very much seeing crime on the increase. I just hope that people get back to their law enforcement organizations, supplying the necessary men, the necessary money to do the job. In the Highway Patrol, for example, we are going to ask the legislature for about 40 more men during the next 2 years to cut this upsurge in traffic accidents. I think that over the country, more attention has got to be given to the resources of the police department in doing the job that they're supposed to do, and that goes for all law enforcement agencies.
Jay, we appreciate very much your taking the time to come tonight.
It was a pleasure to be here with
you. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest next week will be Mr. Joseph Rosenblatt, Utah industrialist whose firm is known throughout the world in his production of mining equipment. We hope you'll be with us for that occasion. Thank you and good night.
Started at 8:30 p.m. 1960.